as you've been, the more long you've been around, the more accepted you are. Because the people that were there at the beginning who were like 19 are now not teenagers, and the other ones, you know, they just accept you if you've been around for about 4 or 5 years. So they start thinking there might be something in it after all.
I always wanted to be a musician. I always wanted to be in a band.
What's your ambition now?
To be a musician.
Nobody else knew what to do, so you had to make the whole thing up as you went along.
The way you looked was a big part of it. It wasn't the only part of it. It's how you acted, how you spoke.
Days of playing in a suit over, and it's also bloody uncomfortable.
Even though we didn't really do that many shocking things in the early days, people were easily shocked.
Today there's so much variety that I don't think that I don't think band could happen quite that same way. To me, it's just in a day's work.
The Rolling Stones are arguably the most renowned and enduring band of all time. Their music has spanned over 5 decades, influencing generations.
Yeah, I heard things for good, you know, 50 years. It seems an awfully long time, but it seems to have gone very, very quickly.
Good looking back. Oh, it's quite amusing. Except when it isn't, of course. But mostly it's good.
To this day, the band is still going strong, selling out tours around the world and releasing albums that still top the charts. Their unique sound and personalities are what has set them apart from every other band to date.
Why have you stayed together as long as you have?
Because we enjoy it.
This is another insight into an ongoing machine and institution that will never stop rumbling.
I mean, it's in one of the most important rock bands in so far in music history. I mean, yeah, you can't really deny that.
Anybody should be interested in when we're going to quit. It should be the Stones. And they're not particularly interested in that.
Rolling Stones. There they are.
Dartford Station, Kent, 1962. By chance, former classmates Mick Jagger and Keith Richards meet on the railway platform. Keith spots Mick's records, and in that moment, the greatest friendship in recent history begins.
He's got the best of Muddy Waters and Rocking at the Hops by Chuck Berry under his arm, you know.
Hey, man.
Nice to see you, but where'd you get the records?
A few months later, the new musical duo meet their future drummer and lead guitarist at the Ealing Club in London. Charlie Watts and Brian Jones were playing with fellow blues musician Alexis Corner.
Yeah, he played with Alexis and the band that Alexis had that Charlie was playing drums in. He actually persuaded Alexis to let him get on stage and play. And he heard an Elmore James record for the first time in his life, which I never heard one until about 65 or something, 64. He said the whole universe shuddered, you know, when he heard this, you know, that slide thing. He immediately got a slide and started playing, and there he was playing when Mick and Keith first went to see the Alexis Corner band.
After this meetup, Brian Jones decided to bring them all together and form the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, Brian named the band, formed the band, rehearsed. It was his idea, everything was him, yeah.
What were you doing before you joined?
Well, just sort of bumming around waiting for something to happen, really. You know, I had quite a few jobs and I was trying to get a band going, but it was unsuccessful until I met up with Mick and Keith.
From there, the band posted auditions for a bassist and were absolutely blown away when they heard Bill Wyman. The band were heavily inspired by the 40s and 50s blues and rock and roll because of their hard-hitting guitar riffs and relatable lyrics that reflected the post-war world. Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, Elmore James, and Buddy Holly were all inspirations. The Stones began as a blues-inspired rock band, but were forced to label themselves R&B to get noticed.
No, it wasn't the thing to be a rock band, though, really. Not in these clubs we wanted to play in, because it was the thing was it was R and B, which was like...
Because they were jazz clubs, you could get in if you were called R&B.
It was, so we were kind
which
of...
nobody knew what it meant.
Nobody knew, no, really. R&B doesn't mean the same. In those days, R&B meant something else to what it does now. So it meant, like, kind of blues, really blues more than anything, with a beat. So we had to circumvent that. Though, of course, we played rock numbers. We played pop numbers, rock numbers, anything. But we did play loads of blues. And so that's how we wanted to be this R&B band. It was a little bit of a craze at the time.
People didn't know what it was when they heard it, you see. The audience just stood there, like, completely shocked and didn't know how to dance to it or how to react to it. But they never heard the songs, never heard the rhythms. It was bizarre. So we used to sit on stools and smoke cigarettes and drink beers and just play amongst ourselves. And if the audience clapped or something, we kind of looked round and, And if they didn't, we just talked amongst ourselves and carried on. It was a bizarre experience.
In 1963, The Stones showed off their blues influences with their first recorded track, Come On. The single was a hit with UK audiences and stayed on the charts for 14 weeks. The Stones had made their mark and would continue to grow from there.
A Qantas jet arrives at rain-soaked Kingsford Smith Airport, and on board are the pop singers who rival the Beatles for popularity, the Rolling Stones. Despite the rain, about 200 fans wait for the Stones. There's lead singer Mick Jagger, Brian Jones, Keith Richard, and drummer Charlie Watts.
You're rather well-known. First of all, let's deal with some of the numbers. How did all this start?
Well, we just met each other in jazz clubs in London about 2 years ago.
And... The group developed from there.
Yeah, from there, yeah.
Do you write any of your own music at all?
Yeah, quite a bit of it, yeah.
The Rolling Stones were sort of forged by the blues, which then sort of represented a kind of an authenticity and a danger and a kind of an edginess. And they were named after Muddy Waters' song, and they covered loads of blues songs. And in a way, that's always been the sort of the heart of the sound, and I suppose the heart of how they feel about themselves.
My first awareness of the Stones were that they were this kind of threat to society, you know, these kind of hooligan delinquents who were just doing naughty things. Like
in those days, what the press portrayed as wild was actually, you know, in our world now quite tame, you know, but for those days, people were easily shocked. You've got to remember that it was still a very shockable society. There wasn't the kind of scandal mongering quite in this way as there is now, which is, you know, sort of scandal on a daily basis as a staple diet of our thing. So, but they love scandal, of course, the newspaper. So they used to play it up a lot. But and so even though we didn't really do that many shocking things in the early days, people were easily shocked.
I don't remember my parents saying very much about them, and I think my parents, you know, kind of had a reasonably liberal and tolerant attitude towards the Stones. But I sort of was intrigued, you know. It was something about Jagger and his strange sort of androgynous quality, these lips and this incredible kind of swagger that he had.
In 1963, 19-year-old Andrew Loog Oldham signed as the band's new producer. He saw their potential as rising stars and wanted to give them a brand new look. He transformed the Stones into rebellious bad boys.
They were managed, apparently, at the time by Georgia Grimalski, who went on to manage the Yardbirds. And Andrew obviously made a very good presentation to Mick that he should have Andrew as his manager. And Giorgio got second best with the Yardbirds.
Andrew had this real talent for sort of making a splash and a fuss and centering attention on you, which would have taken us a lot longer probably. We hadn't had someone like Andrew. And he was younger than any of us. So he had a very young and very, very irreverent attitude.
Later that year, Oldham asked John Lennon and Paul McCartney to help create a new original song for the band. The result was I Wanna Be Your Man, which was released to huge success.
I wanna be your man, I wanna be your man,
After a few months with the band, Oldham secured the Rolling Stones a UK tour and a US tour. And by 1964, they had become one of the most popular bands in the UK, US, and Australia, with their closest competitors being their once collaborators, the Beatles.
How do you compare your group with the Beatles?
I don't know. How do you compare it with the Beatles? I don't compare it at all. You know, there's no point.
Well, let's get right down to the brass tacks. Do you think you're better than they are?
What? You know, it's not the same group, so we just do what we want and they do what they want. And you can prefer us to them or them to us. Mm. This is diplomatic, you see.
Very diplomatic, and I don't want to labour it, but do you feel you do what you want to do better than they do what they want to do?
Yes. Probably. I don't know. I don't know what they want to do, you see. Very diplomatic.
The Rolling Stones' debut single came out only about a year after the Beatles, and the Beatles had such a kind of instant impact, but they were kind of, there was something very friendly about them, that they definitely represented the kind of new energies of the 60s and youth. And Andrew Lew Goldham very smartly positioned the Stones as the kind of threatening ones, that they were the ones for the, you know, for the older siblings.
What do you think about John Lennon's returning the medal, the Order of British?
At last.
Yes, it's a long time. It should have done it as soon as you got it, I thought.
They were the ones that had this kind of, this sexuality and this menace and this whole idea of, you know, would you let your daughter go out with a Rolling Stone?
You know, what the Stones represented, particularly to, you know, to young girls in the 60s, was in contrast to what the Beatles represented. And one important thing the Stones did, and they were the first to do it really, was they stopped wearing, like, matching suits. I think that Andrew Oldham has to take some credit for saying, OK, you know, we are just going to do something a bit more natural. And I mean, that sounds kind of like fairly innocuous now, but then it was quite a statement. It was like, we don't care.
The way you looked was a big part of it, wasn't the only part of it. It's how you acted, how you spoke, what you said in the songs and everything. But it never was a sort of sit down in a committee and trying to cultivate
it. It became obvious to Andrew that there was a market out there that wanted something that the people could rebel against their parents. And Andrew just encouraged them to wear their own clothes, and they got slowly, well, decidedly rougher and harder. And that's how the image got developed.
You'd see pictures of Jagger, and you know, they looked like bad boys, you know, as opposed to the Beatles, who you kind of had a sense were just more affable and sort of cheeky chappy, and you know, kind of boys next door in a way, you know. So the Stones were very clearly positioned as the sort of the bad boys in contrast to the Beatles.
We never really consciously cultivated this anti-hero image thing. It was just the way things evolved. And then people tried to get us to wear uniforms at a certain point. I don't really know why.
I was heavily into the design and the image, really. And it was away from the Beatles, everyone looking the same in suits and ties.
There was something just much, I think probably just sexier, blacker, funkier, darker, more dangerous about the Stones. You know, their grooves just had a sort of dirty, primal sort of quality to them, but also a poetic quality. Whereas, you know, I love the Beatles, but I couldn't have followed them to the ends of the earth.
In 1964, the band released the single Little Red Rooster and achieved their first number one hit.
Teenagers went barmy.
You must remember that a number one in those days was a real number one. It wasn't just you went to number one and you'd sold 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 singles. Today you're lucky to do it on 30 or 40,000.
The band was finally a chart-topping success. In 1965, the Rolling Stones released what would be one of their most celebrated songs, Satisfaction. No. No. Hey, hey, hey.
Channeling their rock and roll influences, this track stood out to audiences as it mirrored the frustrated society of the early 60s. The track was a massive hit, and finally their original songs were attracting audiences.
When you listen to early rock and roll songs, going through from like the mid-50s to the mid-60s really, loads of songs are basically have got this kind of itchy impatient. They're young men who are just desperate to get laid, essentially. That is the inspiration for loads of the early rock and roll songs. And Satisfaction is maybe the best example of that. It's this constant kind of itchiness. I need something to happen. And there's just a way that on one level that song is kind of, you know, it's pretty trivial. And on another way, it seems to be the most important message. It's just like you're always wanting. There's just this sort of appetite and drive, and you need something to happen and you need to get what you want.
Satisfaction was the real break record. I can remember we were driving along the Pacific Coast Highway and we punched a station and it played Satisfaction. We punched the next button, it was Satisfaction. All five stations on the five buttons were playing Satisfaction. We knew they broke the record.
The track was such a hit in the United States at that time. It was even featured as a cover on the NBC musical variety television show Hullabaloo in 1965.
David Winters is going to dance to one of those swinging wild arrangements. So, ladies and gentlemen, David Winters dances Peter Mance.
The Rolling Stones' early career went from positive to positive. They had signed to Decca Records, increased their popularity around the world, and by 1966, the Stones had released six studio albums, including their critically praised number one album, Aftermath. However, during the mid to late 60s, culture was reshaping, changing the way music sounded.
In another example of the recent social phenomenon that's sweeping the country, it's a giant love-in, close relative to the be-in. Sort of a happy happening, laced with the rites of spring. The slogans were just as frank as ever. Hippies, would-be hippies, and just plain folks made a colorful scene with wild costumes, uninhibited dancing, and general high frolic.
The attitude was you had something which was all about, you know, love, nice things, you know. You didn't want to go to beaches and fight people. You wanted to sit, listen to music, dress up. The parties were more colourful. It must have been a great time to be in London. I wish I was there then, you know.
By 1967, the hippie movement was in full swing. During this year, the Beatles travelled to India to reinvent themselves and search for new inspiration, resulting in the release of the band's eighth album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
I mean, there was no music like it before. The whole, the cover, everything. It put what was probably something not everyone was maybe aware of on the map.
The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album was revolutionary. It was terrific. It's the cover designed by Peter Blake, the music. It's very difficult nowadays to imagine the impact that that had on a kind of black and white world.
The Rolling Stones also wanted to change their style and join the hippie movement. In December, the Stones released their album, Their Satanic Majesty's Request, an album that was to supposedly drive the Rolling Stones into the hippie world and bring psychedelic pop into their music.
So they were sort of in step with the Beatles for a while, and you could say that Satanic Majesty's Request was sort of their Sgt. Pepper, much less good than Sgt. Pepper. But around the time of when Satanic Majesty's Request came out, I think that they sort of realised it wasn't really true to them. It didn't feel right, it didn't feel authentic.
It's difficult to tell whether you affect or you are affected by us, with things like flower power. I don't know. We were getting into sort of beads and hats and flowers when we did the London Palladium show last Christmas. But so we got a bit fed up with it before the summer came.
Because of commercialisation.
No, because we were just sick of it after about 2 or 3 months. When you're talking about flower power, I don't mean ethically, I just mean very superficially, the beads and the flowers and everything. Okay.
The way Keith Richards looks back on it was that he kind of woke up one day and, you know, I'm feeling pretty angry about all of this, and we're not really making music that's, I mean, Ruby Tuesday is not, it's not me, you know. She's a rainbow. It's not true to Keith Richards' spirit. Correspondingly, at the same time, you know, they were busted. They were targeted by the police and, to some extent, by the media. And I think they felt, you know, it's almost like they were victims of this whole swinging London psychedelic Carnaby Street thing. So it's almost like the hippie fantasy, you know, everyone was kind of wearing flowers in their hair, had sort of come around and bitten them on the arse. You know, it hadn't worked well for them, and it wasn't really musically true to their own blues roots, I think.
Not only did their album only peak third on the charts, the band had been targeted for drug use by the police and media. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were arrested for possession, as well as losing Andrew Oldham as their producer.
As the 60s developed, the national newspapers, which had now taken rock and roll to its front pages, became more and more interested in rock stars. So therefore, they'd spent years being utilized by people like Andrew Oldham to build up their artists. So now they were interested in trying to bring them down.
A national newspaper had tipped off the police to raid Keith Richards' house at West Wittering. In the house were found traces of cannabis resin and a pipe in which cannabis had been smoked. Evidence that an unnamed naked woman was sitting on a sofa with a rug around her was given in court today.
You know, inevitably, the Stones find themselves at the centre of this new counterculture, this new, quite decadent scene. You know, drugs come in. Drugs came in very early for everybody. I mean, you know, everyone was smoking weed in the early 60s. I mean, much earlier than anybody realises, I think. And they were already, you know, starting to drop acid by 65, 66. So, you know, by 69, you know, Keith is using both coke and smack. You have to say that those drugs do contribute to the sound of the Stones.
Soon after Mick and Keith's drug allegations, Brian Jones was also arrested for drug possession, giving the media more reason to portray the Rolling Stones in a negative light.
Across town, Brian Jones faced charges for possession of drugs. Jones admitted that he had taken drugs in the past to a slight extent. Passing sentence, Mr. Reginald Seaton told Jones, "You occupy a position by which you have a large following of youth, and therefore it behoves you to set an example."
Jones was charged in his full name of Lewis Brian Jones, a musician. His long fair hair was rumpled and he wore an open-necked shirt with a flowered pattern. Detective Sergeant Robin Constable asked for a remand so that a substance which he said had been found when police called at Jones's flat between 6 and 7 this morning could be analysed. It's alleged that the substance was cannabis and Jones is charged with illegal possession of it.
The hippie era was a disastrous time for the band. Because of this, the Stones decided to move away from the flower power movement and go back to their dark blues roots. In 1968, the band released their intense single, Jumpin' Jack Flash, followed by the release of Beggar's Banquet.
So the psychedelic thing just went out the window, and instead came in this kind of slightly disheveled, I can only call it, it's like a sort of, they will look like aristocratic tramps. You know, you look at the sleeve of Beggar's Banquet, you know, and there's nothing sort of, there's no sort of paisley or there's no flowers in the hair, there's nothing, they look like, you know, they look quite sinister, actually, quite sinister. So out of that comes Jumpin' Jack Flash, which is just like, wow. I mean, what is that? It's just a million miles from Ruby Tuesday. It's dark, it's lo-fi, it's gritty, it's got this slightly satanic element. It's much more satanic than Satanic Majesty's Request. You know, who is Jumping Jack Flash? Is that the devil, you know?
They were better when they were moving into this kind of, this sort of darker, more turbulent territory. And there was always that sense that they played on, and in fact, the tabloids certainly expanded on, was the sense that they were dangerous.
They seemed to be channeling the zeitgeist. And the zeitgeist is we've gone past this sort of love and peace thing, and we've gone into something that's much more edgy and frightening. And so I think they turn rock and roll into something really quite dark and primal and alluring and sexy and sinister. And it turned into this glorious run of records.
And in the late 60s, you have this incredible run of songs where Gimme Shelter, which is really sort of sums up this apocalyptic end of the 60s vibe. Sympathy for the Devil, you know, in which he gets to be, he gets to be Lucifer. It's inspired by Bulgakov's novel, The Master and Margarita. So it's quite a kind of highbrow illusion, but which created this wonderful kind of like feverish evil samba feel, which again sounded like its era. You can't always get what you want, which was almost this great sort of epitaph for the 60s, and Street Fighting Man, which is ostensibly a protest song inspired by, you know, Mick attending an anti-war rally. But actually, it's about him not being a protest singer. It's going, what can I do, you know, but sing in a rock and roll band? And they didn't need to be sort of particularly convincing politically. Their very existence seemed, you know, rebellious and significant.
Unfortunately, just before the release of Beggar's Banquet, Brian Jones was arrested again for drug possession. Because of this, his involvement in the band and Beggar's Banquet was almost non-existent. His focus became primarily on drugs.
Brian Jones was a really important part of the Stones for a long time. He really knew about blues. He really understood about blues. He brought something very unique and important into the Stones. But as we all know, he really started to unravel.
Tension between Brian and the band rapidly increased. His court hearing denied him permission to go abroad for the Rolling Stones US tour. And by 1969, Mick and Keith decided he was a liability. It was time for him to go.
Brian's drug abuse was so appalling. He was incapable of playing. And he wasn't really fired. He was just told goodbye. He was, you know, it just happened that he was no longer available as a competent human being to turn up to record or to play.
It was very important to us, the fact that we were going to go back out on the road behind a new record, that we resolved this thing with Brian. So Mick and I had to go down and sort of tell Brian virtually, like, hey, cock, you're fired.
A month later, the devastating news hit the band and the fans. Brian Jones had died in his own swimming pool.
Charlie phoned me up. Phone went about 3 a.m. and I just like got off to sleep after about an hour. Charlie phoned me up and he just said Brian died.
Fans and bandmates gathered to watch as Brian Jones was laid to rest. The 27-year-old rock star's career had come to an end.
Nobody was really that surprised, too.
there are people, I mean, I'm sure that everybody's got those feelings about certain people. Everybody knows people that you just have that feeling about that they're not going to be 70 years old ever, you know. That not everybody makes it, you know.
Later that year, the band threw together a remembrance gig at Hyde Park to bring everyone together to remember Brian.
The one remains, the many change and pass. Heaven's light forever shines, earth's shadows fly. Life, like a dome of many colored glass, stains the white radiance of eternity until death tramples it to fragments.
Unfortunately, problems didn't stop there for the Stones. Late into their US tour, that was to promote their new album, Let It Bleed, they were to experience one of the darkest days in rock and roll history, the free concert at Altamont.
The 1969 tour of America is a really quite a big tour. You know, they play Madison Square Gardens, and it culminates in this free concert that they give near San Francisco in December 69. They felt like they should do something like Woodstock. So this really hastily put together and rather ill-advised, ill-conceived event takes place at the Altamont Speedway. The Hells Angels are drafted in as the security, you know, service. And it just, from the get-go, turns very nasty. They beat up Marty Balin of the Jefferson Airplane. I mean, this is one of the artists, you know, and they're meant to be the security guys, you know, and anyone who gets anywhere near this pathetic little stage that's about 5 feet off the ground, you know, is beaten up. And right in front of Mick Jagger, you know, this guy is murdered, is knifed to death. And Jagger doesn't realise that's happening in the there and now. They have lost control and he's out of his depth. He doesn't know what to do. It was a really scary moment. It was a real reality check for them. You know, I think the Stones went in a more hedonistic direction and a slightly less political direction. It's almost like, okay, we're not spokesmen for our generation anymore, and we're gonna go in just a more kind of funky, hedonistic, sort of aristocratic jet set, you know, Stones in exile, kind of partying in the south of France, sort of direction, I think. Which doesn't mean the music is it, but it's just less. It is not channeling the darker elements of the zeitgeist, and I think so. Something changes in the Stones' mindset at that point.
After the terrible events of 1969, the band was to change their sound again. Mick Taylor was to replace Brian Jones and help them break away from the politics and dark theme lyrics they were expressing in Beggar's Banquet and Let It Bleed, and bring in a much more funky, upbeat sound to them.
Now, when Brian went, and Brian was already effectively replaced by Mick Taylor, that was a really important change to the sound and style of the Stones as well. Mick Taylor brought in a real virtuosity, a really different kind of guitar style and tone to Keith, and there was just a brilliant kind of contrast and counterpoint there that I think was really important.
Mick Taylor's involvement with the band helped them to write music and lyrics that were to get away from the political statements and focus more on relatable, less antagonizing themes.
It's easy to forget what a great lyricist Jagger was, you know, what brilliant words he wrote in the Stones' heyday. I mean, you know, he can still write lyrics, but he was really paying attention, you know, in that great period, you know. So you read the lyrics to sort of Wild Horses, you know, it's a very different thing, a kind of song of pain and breakup, addressed to Marianne Faithfull. Wild horses couldn't drag me away. I mean, they're pretty great lyrics, you know, they really are, and you felt like he really cared about the craft of songs. So you put, you put those two guys together, I mean, they just wrote, I mean, dozens of the greatest songs ever, I think, you know, really, really do. They were really on it. They were really on their game.
I think the Stones are often known for this kind of, you know, the swaggering rock and rollers, you know, Tumbling Dice and Start Me Up, and then the kind of dark, menacing stuff, Painted Black and Gimme Shelter. But they're quite underrated as writers of love songs, could be surprisingly tender. But songs like Wild Horses and Moonlight Mile and Angie, and they could convey great sensitivity as well.
After Let It Bleed in 1969, the band left Decca and started their own label, Rolling Stones Records. The Rolling Stones released their most landmark albums during this time, such as Sticky Fingers and Exile on Main Street. Sticky Fingers was so loved by fans that in 1986, bassist Bill Wyman even opened a restaurant under that name, filled with band memorabilia.
Sticky Fingers came from Stones album, and I thought it was a great name for a restaurant.
Weren't you tempted to call it Goat's Head Soup?
Well, I didn't think people would eat there. But there were a few names, Beggar's Banquet, there was lots of...
At this point in their career, the Rolling Stones had become world-known. They had given a new image to the world of rock and pop music and redefined what a rock star looked like. They had gone from being the rebellious kids of the 60s to international rock icons.
Hey, Mick, in these press conferences, you seem to be called on to play a kind of philosopher king role. And,
which is impossible to do.
How do you feel about being placed in that position of tastemaker and philosophy maker?
I withdraw from it totally into banality if it continues.
Central to the whole idea of rock and roll and pop music is this idea that you create yourself, you create your own mythology. And the Stones were always very attuned to that. You know, they were mostly kind of middle-class, suburban, small-town kids that were really into blues, had sort of sang a sort of transatlantic accent. There was a kind of... weirdly, they were sort of seen as authentic. But, of course, they weren't. They were creating characters of themselves. Why one of the best songs is Jumpin' Jack Flash, because instantly it was like, I was born in a crossfire hurricane. It's amazing. And, of course, he wasn't. He was, like, born in Dartford. So their whole kind of message was really, I think, about this sense of reinventing yourself and a very potent time in British culture.
I firmly believe that today that Andrew is not given the true recognition for what he did for most people in the industry today. His imagery of Mick Jagger and then the devil in Keith Richards set up rock and roll to get it onto the front page of the newspapers. It became television news, it became newspaper news. And it set a standard people have tried to copy and follow. Many have followed. I don't think anybody really surpassed what was achieved in that 64 to 65 period. It was number one after number one, you know, Get Off of My Cloud, Satisfaction, 19th Nervous Breakdown. I mean, these are classic rock and roll, pop rock and roll records.
They just become a magnet for the cool people and the most beautiful women, and everybody wants to be around the Stones. It's the allure of what they stand for. They're just, you know, there isn't anything cooler than Keith Richards in 1969, 1970, 71. He just defined cool, really, because he wasn't trying to be cool. He just sort of, you know, the Keith Richards wardrobe is just slinging together. It's like a dressing up box. It's like just, you know, I'll put that jacket on, I'll put this, wrap this scarf around my neck, you know, and I'll put on these sunglasses. And it just was so natural, I think. You know, that's why he's a real style icon.
And I wanted to present it that I'm not totally, you know, this sort of rock and roll maniac. You know, I mean, when I go mad, I do it on purpose.
You know? You know, some of Mick's choices are a bit kind of weird, really, but he was still cool too.
Mick Jagger was a PE teacher's son from Kent. You know, sort of tall and gangly and very fit, with this kind of huge oversized mouth, like odd looking. And he became that, he sort of made that like, oh, this is what a rock star looks like. This is how you move. He had this kind of, this strut, this sort of weird, like, say, predatory sexuality, a sort of flamboyance that was slightly, you know, it wasn't straight heterosexuality. You know, there was a sort of complexity there. And that became like the model of how one should be. And even now, you know, even in his 70s, there's sort of very peculiar, very sort of fluid about the way he moves. And that's something that he's preserved throughout his life. I think the thing with Mick Jagger is this appetite. He has this incredible appetite to be a star, to be around, and that it could be in terms of, you know, glamorous girlfriends. It could be turning up at, you know, Studio 54. That could be collaborating with lots of different people. That could be having political phases. He does the things that a kind of rock star is meant to do.
I really like the silhouettes. You know, I like the you know, it's a good, really good look for a woman. And she's really
he's
going
always
to
wanted to have all these fingers in different pies. He's always wanted to be more than just the singer in the band.
I do try and do other things apart from the Rolling Stones. At one time, it was the only thing in your life, you know, but as you get older, there are other things that come along that take your time on. And so, you know, now I think it's on a very level keel so that it can be enthusiastic about it, but it's not the only thing in your life, and I think that's normal.
Keith, on the other hand, is basically the guitarist in the Rolling Stones. You know, he was the one that always resisted, you know, when they were interested, when Mick was interested in synthesizers or disco or reggae, Keith was like, no, not really. Basically wants to do blues rock. There's this great sort of, you know, this tension between that Mick, I always think, does the things that we're meant to admire in stars, you know, being very kind of daring and taking risks and trying all these different things. And Keith represents what we're meant to sort of disdain, which is being quite conservative and quite stuck in his ways and resistant to change. And yet people love Keith because he sort of never changes, because he's this weird sort of grizzled pirate character.
Maybe it's just because I'm just me and, you know, there's no artificial crap about me, you know. I just tell it like it is. And
I think people are quite suspicious of Mick. You know, that there's something that seems quite sort of opportunistic about him. And I've always felt that perhaps that was slightly unfair, because Mick was often the person that was pushing the Stones to try different things that sort of stopped them from essentially becoming, you know, relics that kind of kept them moving through the 80s, that kept them, you know, adapting and surviving. Whereas if it was up to Keith, I get the feeling that they would have basically been frozen in time in around sort of, you know, 1972.
You felt like that Keith was the real sort of engine room of the Stones, the real creative sort of force, and this kind of slightly dark foil to Jagger. I always think that Keith Richards is really underestimated as a writer, as a composer of music. You know? But I was fascinated by Jagger. I still think he was the greatest front man that ever was. You know, when he was wearing those slightly Elvis-y sort of rhinestone one-piece, like, bodysuit things, he was just magnificent.
If you have Mick but no Keith, you have a band that would be very ambitious, but perhaps pretentious, somewhat pretentious and a little rootless. And if you have Keith but no Mick, you just probably have a really solidly enjoyable blues rock band. And it's the fact that they're, and the reason why they often don't get on, is that they want quite different things. They've, you know, very different personalities. They've got very different artistic visions. And yet they agree on this, they find this one thing that they agree on. And it's the push and pull that made them such a powerful band.
In 1974, Mick Taylor, unfortunately, decided to leave the band to begin his solo career. The ex-Byrds guitarist, Ronnie Wood, later replaced him. In the 1980s, the band became extremely heated. Their ideas conflicted, as both Mick Jagger and Keith Richards couldn't see eye to eye anymore. Mick wanted to focus on his solo career, leaving Keith as the main writer in the studio. Their music heavily suffered throughout this decade.
But for a good number of years, you know, Mick and Keith are this amazing team, amazing kind of couple, like a married couple creatively. But I think, they start to to sort of pull apart. You know, Keith just sinks deeper and deeper into the kind of quagmire of addiction. Mick is more interested in sort of expanding his horizons. Ultimately, he's more interested in the beautiful people, more interested in the Andy Warhol set. And I think they start to pull apart creatively. They're not the best of friends anymore. You know, Mick has grown tired of trying to manage Keith. You know, Keith has become quite scornful of Mick's pretensions and airs and graces. And by the mid-80s, you know, Keith looks back and describes it as World War III. They're really separate camps.
That's the way things are. Guys don't work together for 50 years almost without having the odd, contretemps.
Relationships over a long period, it's like they go very up and down, and sometimes they're good and sometimes they're not very good. I mean, the Rolling Stones, we have lots of, you know, in any internal kind of group of people always have varying relationships with each other, so the dynamic changes. But, you know, I mean, we have sort of common goals, and so we try and get over the ups and downs and try and keep on the common goal.
And this is so common in really successful rock bands. I mean, it happened with Lennon and McCartney. It happened with Jimmy Page and Robert Plant in Led Zeppelin. You know, it happens time and time again when you've got two alpha males, particularly, you know, who's the boss? You know, who is the boss? And they both thought that they were the boss.
The Rolling Stones remarkably stayed together throughout this heated decade. Their fame was so monumental, fans around the world wanted to see them. Their branding was so recognizable that they were able to sell out tours around the world instantly, allowing them to become one of the biggest touring bands of that time.
By the 80s, the Rolling Stones live, the Rolling Stones touring had become this, you know, massive business. And, you know, they are extremely wealthy as a result.
They really became the band as corporation. Mick Jagger's mouth became the logo of the band. They made so many very canny business decisions while at the same time seeming, you know, presenting this image of being these kind of like decadent, slightly out of control, you know, the epitome of rock debauchery. And yet behind the scenes, they were so smart and they were laying the foundations for their survival. And so I think of Rolling Stones as the epitome of the band that's also a business.
It's a very nice crowd, I mean, everyone's obviously very happy, but it's record of 650,000 now.
You could say, well, the thing got just sort of way out of proportion, the scale of these live shows, you know, these massive stadiums they're playing, and maybe the soul of the Rolling Stones kind of took a back seat. You know, you go to one of those shows and they're just these like dots on the stage and blown up massively on screens. And, you know, they've come so far from their blues roots, you know, playing around Richmond. And a lot of those artists from that era have a kind of status that relies on what you might call baby boomer nostalgia.
You know, the older people go to see the Stones concert and they wait for the old hits, because quite frankly, the hits that Andrew produced with them weren't necessarily the greatest records of all time, but each record was a statement. And it's a statement that the Stones have come to live by, and it's a statement that everybody's copied and followed since.
I think the Stones have just been able to some degree, just rely on that. That's never going to change. They don't have to do very much to get millions of people coming out to see them.
The Rolling Stones tours continued into the 90s, but unfortunately lost them Bill Wyman, who, like Mick Taylor, wanted to follow his solo career. During this decade, the band set aside their differences, went back to releasing albums, as well as continuing to tour around the world. In 2012, the Rolling Stones hit a landmark of 50 years in the music industry. An incredible achievement that only few have achieved.
Definitely rocking, yes. And yeah, I think it's good, you know, 50 years. It seems an awfully long time, but it seems to have gone very, very quickly. That's like a flash. Yeah, it does go fast, it's true. It goes super fast, so yeah, enjoy it while you can. It seems that we did enjoy it while we could.
I've been asked, I keep asking the same questions. I keep saying, what's the other one? Did you think when you started out you were going to do this for 50 years? Of course we did. I thought I would be sitting next to Charlie for the next 50 years talking to him about the Beats. If you'd have asked me that question a bit later, I would have perhaps answered. But that was a correct answer at the time, because no one had ever really lasted very long, so why would you last? It's a bit presumptuous to think that you were going to last at all any more than anybody else. Why should you? You know what I mean? It wasn't a kind of long-term industry in those days.
This was then followed by the band's own exhibition in 2015, a chance to allow fans to see their history, untold stories, and allowed them to experience life in the Stones' shoes throughout their rocking years.
We've been thinking about it actually for quite a long time, collecting things, thinking about, oh, this would be good, we'd better save this because we want people to see it, you know, we want people to see this, we want people to see that. Yes, I mean, it is a kind of look at your career, and I think it's kind of an interesting time to do it. We've got enough stuff, in fact, too much stuff.
I'm getting a bit emotional walking around it, and you think you know it all and everything, but especially the old flat. Yeah, I looked at that and I said, I'm ready to crash out.
But there are things I've never seen. I mean, the most poignant one in there was Eric Easton and Brian's contract that he signed on our behalf. I remember him doing it, actually, not signing it, but going to do it, because we weren't allowed to go up to the office.
And also I'm finding, you know, some of my favourite clothes that I realise that they have found, and I think, damn it, you know, that's where I left those boots. I've been looking them for years, you know.
As you walk through this exhibition, you can see it goes through all these different eras, and all these different things have happened around the rock band, so to speak, so it becomes part of more than just being a rock band.
Yeah, it's just like another interim in this adventure that we're on, you know, so it's a good thing that we're still working, you know, and this is going on in the background, which is good.
One of the reasons the Stones sometimes seem like the archetypal rock band is this almost like a movie-like perfection to some of the things that happened to them. You know, the Redlands drug bust, where they almost, you know, went to prison, the death of Brian Jones. These are these huge kind of sort of symbols of rock stardom tipping over into something darker. You know, this symbol of sort of like of rock and roll decadence. Was in fact, I mean, and Keith Richards' consumption was astonishing and lasted for a very long time. But Mick Jagger is, you know, PE teacher's son. He's a very healthy guy. And so he was not this, you know, he was not this sort of enormous drug hoover at all. It was almost like the symbolism of it is the various things that happened to them, the records they made, they all sort of conveyed this message that this is kind of, these are these rock and outlaws, you know, living on the edge. And yet, of course, at the same time, you know, keeping a very close eye on business affairs and merchandising.
I mean, I think the Stones will keep going until they drop. I have no doubt of that, until they can no longer stand up. I can't imagine they will actually play with Zimmer frames, but I wouldn't put it past Mick. So, you know, they've got a little while left, I think.
There are some retrospectively very funny quotes from Mick Jagger from around 1969, where he's just like saying, oh, I can't imagine doing this when I'm 30. Wouldn't this be ridiculous? And quite a lot of the time they just go, oh, you can't be the Rolling Stones and like old. And by old, they basically meant over 30.
You know, but no one could see beyond 30 at that point. So now it's like, you're going to be doing this when you're 80, Mick.
Have you still got the rebellion? Because there were those brilliant headlines, wasn't there? Lock up your daughters, the Stones are coming.
Lock up your grandmothers now, they say.
Does it make you laugh now you've got kids and grandkids that was written about you?
I did this show in the southern United States, and there was a poster outside this college, and it said, Mick Jagger slept with your grandmother. It was a joke, so it's quite funny, really.
The Stones were very good for quite a long time. You know, they obviously outlasted the Beatles. You know, the great 60s albums, then Sticky Fingers and Exile on Main Street in the 70s, these really kind of totemic records, some people's favourites. And, you know, they continued to be pretty good through the 70s. And then they dropped off. And then they became sort of, like so many people, kind of persistence. And there's something quite powerful about that. You know, even though the younger Mick Jagger would have sort of laughed at himself still being on stage now. They're like carved out of rock. They're these sort of historic figures. And there's something weirdly moving about that, seeing the Stones at Glastonbury. It was like, oh, they're still here. And in the 60s, nobody imagined that. Nobody thought that anybody would get to be middle-aged, let alone old, and still be able to, like, sell out, you know, big shows and still have anyone care about their records.
It is rock and roll. That's all I know, and that's all I'm good at. And, you know, I'm a terrible plumber. And I'm just telling it like it is, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
And the Stones are really sort of the pioneers of age, of tenacity, of growing old, and yet somehow they became sort of frozen in time. If you see Mick and Keith now, they haven't really sort of settled down. They're versions of their younger selves. So they've become iconic in a way that I don't think they could have predicted when they were younger.
Fame is something that you have to learn to live with, because it comes along when you don't really think about that when you're doing it. You say, I want to make a record, you know, I want to make some good records. And then you do, and then suddenly this thing called fame comes in. and you have to learn a whole new game, you know, to deal with that, you know.
Any band that sort of combines rock and roll with rhythm and blues draws on the Stones, you know, and I'm thinking about every band from, you know, Aerosmith to Guns N' Roses. They all have to say, well, you know, they've all got to doff their caps to the Rolling Stones, because the Stones, you know, invented that style and that template. They will always be influential, I think. I don't think the Stones' influence will ever, you know, fade out of rock and roll, because they absolutely embodied and encapsulated it.
I say God bless the Rolling Stones.
Yeah,
that's
best.
What I say. Greatest rock band.
John and I went to the concert recently after the 12-12 concert in New York, and they were better than ever, so yeah, I thought.
Yeah.
Well, I always say, if the Stones can keep going, if I can keep saying Mick up there, then it's okay for us to do it, you know? I mean, why should there be an expiration date on rock and roll? I mean, really, I mean, honestly, as long as we're having fun playing the music and it feels good, we should, yeah, we want to keep doing it.
To this day, the band is still touring internationally, attracting fans from all over the world and from all generations. In 2016, the Rolling Stones released their latest studio album, Blue and Lonesome, almost paying a tribute to their legacy, going back to their old roots of the blues.
It feels like they've really gone full circle. I mean, you could say, well, I guess they couldn't think of anything else to do, but why not go back to the beginning? You know, it's a fun thing to do for them. It's kind of grounding them in the reality that they came out of when they were just, you know, a bunch of pale, spotty boys who wanted to be, you know, Muddy Waters, you know.
Amazing. We listened to them back months later and we go, who is that? It must have been recorded in Chicago in the 50s or something, and it's us. And so it's very exciting.
It's
what
different.
The band is all about. Yeah, blues, really. It's about us.
It's nice just to sort of hear their love of that music and just to go back to the sort of source, you know, the oracle that inspired them in the first place.
The Rolling Stones will never cease to be around. Their rich history and landmark albums will always take place in people's lives and continue to influence future generations to come. The Rolling Stones are the essence of rock royalty and will forever be remembered for how they changed the world and music forever.